Welcome to the Minor Consult, where I speak with leaders shaping our world in diverse ways. Today, I'm excited to launch a special series of episodes focused on AI and its potential to transform our health, as well as how we live, work, and lead. I'm delighted to be joined today by Dr. Brian Anderson. Brian is co-founder, president, and CEO of the Coalition for Health AI, known as CHAI. He began his career as a family physician and transitioned to focus on digital health about a decade ago, eventually serving as the chief digital health physician at the nonprofit tech firm MITRE. At CHAI, Brian works with a broad coalition of leaders across healthcare, government, and tech to establish guidelines and guardrails for responsible use of AI in healthcare. Brian, welcome to the Minor Consult. It's great to have you here today.
Lloyd, thanks so much for having me. I've been looking forward to this.
Well, before we dive into AI, I wanted to ask you about your background. It's my understanding that you grew up on the Southern Ute Reservation in Colorado. How did this unique experience influence your decision to pursue a career in medicine?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. It definitely had a pretty significant influence. So growing up, spending time on a reservation, obviously it's a fairly rural environment, small towns, and certainly the place where I grew up was that. You walk down the sidewalks in the local town and families know one another. You know who their kids are, what's going on in their life. And one of the things that I always appreciated was that the doctors that lived in our communities were respected, were known. The families that they took care of knew them. It was real relationships, meaningful relationships, based on trust, common shared interests. And I think from very early days, I wanted to be that kind of member of my community. I wanted to be someone that helped my community members. I wanted to be someone that, you know, had a meaningful part in their lives. And, you know, it seemed like a great opportunity to be a doctor. The pediatrician I had growing up was someone I really respected. And so he was obviously very influential in sending me down the path of becoming a doctor.
Well, that's a fascinating journey. And then after several years in family medicine, you transitioned to focusing on informatics, digital health, and AI. Tell us what motivated you to make that change and what potential did you see in digital health? And how did that transition eventually lead you to co-found the Coalition for Health AI?
Yeah. So, you know, to go back to, you know, the part on the reservation that really influenced me in this space, you have to appreciate that tribes have very few resources when it comes to the kinds of digital infrastructure and technology that many health systems, academic medical centers take for granted. And so what I started doing coming out of medical school was wanting to commit myself to working in that kind of underserved community. And so I started working in federally qualified health centers. And it was in that space that I began to really appreciate the challenges of having an EHR that would empower and enable providers to practice efficiently, to engage with their patients. You know, at the time, as I was practicing after a residency, I wasn't getting home until like 8:30 at night. And it was a real challenge being a husband and a soon-to-be father. And so I began thinking about going into private practice. And I was looking at various EHRs, thinking that, you know, if I found the right EHR that would allow me to be a private practice physician, that would solve my problems. I stumbled upon Athena Health, and I was about to actually sign on the dotted line with them as a solo practitioner, but a friend of mine who was an engineer there said, you know, they had recently hired a CMO. The CMO was looking for another doctor, and I should go interview with the CMO and the leadership team at Athena. And so in the early days then, you know, Athena was much smaller, obviously, than it is now. I really hit it off with our CMO, and next thing I knew, I was leading a clinical services EHR team, and it was really in that space that I began cutting my teeth in informatics. I had a bit of an experience in the informatics and IT world at the FQHC that I was working in, but nothing really compared to what I was learning over the next 8 years as I worked at Athena, growing a team of three to, you know, in excess of 100 in the digital health. And that's really where I got into what we might call traditional AI and some of the predictive models that we were exploring building out across the physician base. From that, a very persistent recruiter at the nonprofit MITRE was, you know, working to share kind of the story of what MITRE was doing at a national level. And they do a lot of work with HHS, with the U.S. government. I ended up moving over and transitioning into MITRE, into the role you described, Chief Digital Health Physician. And it was in that space that I found a really, I think, special spot at the intersection of private stakeholders, so private organizations, and the public sector working together, accomplishing a lot. We partnered with President Biden when he was out of office in the Biden Cancer Initiative. We launched something called the Minimum Common Oncology Data Elements, or M-Code. That's something that now all of the major EHRs have adopted. The vast majority of comprehensive cancer centers now use to help create a foundational set of data elements that accelerate research and identifying the appropriate kind of therapeutics for patients. From there, we launched something called the Vaccination Credential Initiative during the pandemic that allowed us to partner with organizations like the CDC and the U.S. government to create digital cards to the paper CDC cards that we had. And it was really in that pandemic time that the vision for CHAI was born. I was working closely with the White House COVID Task Force and Operation Warp Speed on some data analytics efforts tied to therapeutics and vaccines. And I think we all appreciated you had these traditionally very competitive companies, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, Pfizer, Moderna, Lilly, all working together in a pre-competitive space, right? Focusing on trying to solve this pandemic. And a lot of us appreciated that in working in that space, you can do a lot when you bring the resources to bear of these types of companies. And so we asked, is there something more that we can be doing, something in AI? And that was really the genesis of how we started the Coalition for Health AI. In March of 2021, a number of academics, doctors, and large tech companies got together and asked that question, and that's what set us on this journey.
Well, that's fascinating, and you have had and are having enormous impact in every step. Now let's talk some more about CHAI, and I also want to mention that Stanford Medicine is proudly a founding partner in CHAI. Tell us more about its mission and the role that you envision for CHAI, and why did you feel that there was a need for an organization like CHAI?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, in March of 2021, when we asked that question, one of the specific areas that we were really interested in was, you know, we have what I would call, you know, violent agreement at the 50,000 foot level that, you know, we want AI that's fair. We want AI that's transparent. We want it to be safe and effective. But at a detailed technical level, what does that really mean? Do we have consensus about what fairness means, about what transparency means? And of course, the answer is we don't, right? We have different organizations with different definitions, different good work being done at, you know, companies like Microsoft and Google or Mayo or Stanford, but we don't have the kind of robust sharing and consensus-driven set of definitions at a technical level about what that means. And it's that technical level that's really been the focus within CHAI is, can we get to a granular level of specificity? Because if you do that, right, if I come up with a, this is what the real definition for fairness means, for what unjustified bias means, then I can actually come up with a measurement. If I have an objective definition, I can ideally come up with a metric on how I actually measure that. And then it's with that kind of specific level of a definition and a metric that you can then begin bringing real kinds of transparency to, is a model aligned with what we define as responsible AI, or is it not aligned? And how do we work to get it to be better aligned? And so that's been the focus of CHAI, is building that consensus set of common definitions in a pre-competitive space amongst the various stakeholders across the industry. And that was really the other part of CHAI that has been really exciting, is building this coalition. Started with, you know, a few tech companies and a bunch of doctors at health systems, but it didn't end there, right? So we started with 8 organizations. Very quickly after that, the U.S. government participated. Mickey Tripathi and Troy Tasbaz and Rob Califf from FDA and ONC, now ASTP, joined our effort. And we've really appreciated their continued engagement in our working groups. And it's really been the public sector working alongside the private sector, where you have innovators who are innovating and, you know, all the amazing capabilities that we're seeing, working alongside the regulators, informing the regulators about what the industry best practices are becoming, what these common definitions are, to help inform the regulatory frameworks that they are making. The other part that was really special about CHAI is it brought in other stakeholders, right? So not just health systems, payers, medical device manufacturers, and importantly, patient community advocates. So these are patients with lived disease experience, right? If we espouse and believe that health should be patient-centric, we need to have patients at the center of what we do. So we formed these working groups that have been focused on bringing together this broad stakeholder coalition and ensuring that we have equal voice and equal representation as we build this consensus definition.
There's so much in that, Brian, and congratulations, because you and your colleagues are doing fantastic work in both dealing with topics that are one and the same, nebulous and also extraordinarily consequential. And I was wondering, projecting forward, you began in our conversation today, you were talking about your when you were working in an FUHC and just the hours you spent, and also implicit in that is the hours you spent in documentation and the type of work associated with medical practice that isn't directly patient-facing, and although it indirectly has a profound effect on the health and well-being of patients, it's really not making use of your skills, the skills of other physicians to provide outstanding care, other physicians and other healthcare providers to provide outstanding care to our patients. And you mentioned that you focused a lot on the EHR, and then that led you down the path that ultimately led to CHAI. I was wondering, we've seen advances in EHRs, and I think we're likely to see many more with the implementation of AI. But can you project forward 3 to 5 years and give us some examples that you think will represent the implementation of the types of processes you've just spoken about?
Yeah, great question. it's a really exciting period, certainly, in health, where you see the tools of AI showing some promise in addressing some of the, I would say, existential concerns that many physicians have. The first one that excites me the most is around burnout. Okay. You know, physicians, nurses, all are challenged with the level of documentation that you've described, the need to see patients, you know, in 15 minutes, 30 minutes, to, you know, document everything appropriately, to bill things appropriately, and all the while trying to build a relationship and treat the patient for whatever the modality or the disease is. And AI and, you know, some of the ambient listening technology that's come out is, I think, really exciting. I see and have heard and know providers that come to their administrators in tears, so thankful that the tool, the ambient listening tool that they have, is, you know, reducing the time that they are spending away from their family after hours, that they can actually now have dinner with their kids and their wife. And so that really excites me, that we're going to have fewer providers burning out, more providers having a greater degree of satisfaction and ability to connect with their patients. And hopefully, you know, these kinds of tools will be able to better capture and document and make recommendations to providers on, you know, the best type of quality care that they can get. The other thing that really excites me is AI has this tremendous ability to, you know, meet people where they are. I'm sure many of your listeners have experimented or used ChatGPT or Gemini or any of the other open source models out there and engage with it in a conversational way. And the ability of these tools in 2 to 5 years to be your own personal assistant, to know you well enough, to be tuned and trained to who you are, where you come from, and be able to help you, as an example, navigate a complex healthcare delivery system to find the right provider or the right kind of provider in the right location at the right time to answer your questions. And some of those times it might be questions that you need answered right away. So maybe that's with a chatbot that helps with screening. Maybe that's helping you get access to a mental health provider in a moment of crisis. These are, I think, beginning to see already some real life examples and excitement around where AI tools can meet people, be it in rural environments, inner city environments, suburban environments. And that really excites me. Now, the thing that the catch to that, the thing that concerns me is if we're enabling this much more access, what are we doing on the supply side of physicians and nurses, and how are we augmenting, automating, assisting them in ways that are safe, appropriate, and don't contribute to more burnout? I think ambient listening is one of them, but we have to do a lot more than that. And, you know, that's where I think there's going to be a lot more innovation. And I think a lot more, as a society, we're going to have to come to a common agreement around where AI is safe and effective and able to, you know, in some ways automate certain things, but not keeping a human out of the loop. Where is that line going to be? I think is really going to be a definition or an agreement that we collectively come up with.
I'd like to take that specific example of ambient listening and any others that you'd like to bring in and focus for a moment on the concept of quality assurance labs, because that's been an area of focus for CHAI and an area, I think, of concern and opportunity for all institutions that would really like to be at the forefront both of the development and the deployment of AI in the delivery of healthcare. Would you describe what these quality assurance labs are, and what role do you foresee for them, both in developing guidelines and also ultimately in guiding regulations?
One of the things I always like to remind people is in nearly every other sector of consequence in the U.S. economy or in the global economy for that matter, you have independent entities that test machines, airplanes, cars, electrical devices, the lamps that I have in my office, yep, to make sure that, you know, it's not going to short out and cause a fire, or the plane's not going to crash, or the car and its airbags are going to deploy appropriately. These entities are things that we've come to rely on, right? We almost expect that kind of level of assuredness and testing before we get into the car. Ideally, before we get into the airplane, and we see what happens when that doesn't happen, right? And so with that in mind, when we thought about, well, we have these metrics, we have these, you know, things, who can we turn to give, like, here's how you define quality AI. And we found there is none. There is no set of independent entities in health AI, or in AI for that matter, that does this. And that was a huge concern to many of us, that if we want to build trust in how AI is going to be used in these consequential spaces of health, right? Every one of us is a patient. That is a profoundly intimate thing. I want to trust the tools that a doctor uses on me. I can't trust that without a level of assuredness that comes from someone that's not conflicted out because they have, you know, special interests, someone that actually has the independence and the capabilities to actually evaluate these things rigorously. And so that's where we really realized, like, you know, we can't just stop with creating these definitions and these metrics. We need to support a network of quality assurance labs that can be the trusted partners for health systems, payers, life science companies, essentially the customers of AI models, and patients, and the tech vendors. What we're trying to do is to create a trusted third party that the tech vendors can turn to, that the customers of AI models can turn to, and the patients can turn to understand what is the independent evaluation of this model. Is it safe and effective? Is it biased? Are its claims true? What are the limitations to the model? These are all very, you know, important questions that these labs are going to be answering. And so what CHAI will be doing is we're coming up with a certification framework. How do we ensure that a lab that is certified by CHAI is actually trustworthy, is actually competent and capable, and has high quality data, and can test these models against a diverse set of populations of people across the US? And doing that initially, the focus is in the private sector. So the use case that we're focusing on right now, Lloyd, is this use case of I'm a health system, I'm a payer, I'm a customer, and I am engaged in some RFP process for an AI model. Probably something Stanford is doing, you know, very frequently. You guys are leaders in this space. You're partnering with tech companies. Many of the health systems, as an example in Chai, want to have these models evaluated to, you know, assess the claims of the vendor. It's really challenging to do that, right? You can do that locally. You can deploy it virtually locally. If you have the IT skills and the team that can do that, it's costly. It's challenging. It's not an easy thing. Or you can defer and use what we call an external validation lab. Now, what we're trying to do in Chai is to support both the external labs that do those validations for lower resourced FQHCs or critical access hospitals or community hospitals that don't have an army of IT people that can deploy something virtually and run a virtual trial behind in a dev environment, as well as supporting the local validation of, you know, an AMC that might want to validate a model with some rigor. I'll give you an example of like why this is important. A cardiovascular model was developed at one of Chai's health systems. I won't share the name. And that vendor believed that that model would perform excellently in predicting heart attack in the ED. And so it would be used as a use case for the ED physician. You know, what's the disposition? Where am I going to discharge the patient home or send them upstairs for observation? When the model was tested at that assurance lab, at that health system, the AUC score was fantastic. It was 0.95, but it was 0.95 on highly educated, Caucasian, urban populations of people. When that same lab, because it has a rigorous process, tested that model against underserved communities, African Americans, Latino communities, AUC dropped below 0.5.
Right.
Right. It's worse than a coin flip. The vendor didn't even know that.
Yes.
Now, when the vendor found out about it, obviously there's a way to remediate that. And so that's one of the hopes that we have with these labs, is they're helping train, remediate, and validate.
What do you see as being the ideal relationship and interface between the very valuable information that is coming out of the health assurance labs that you just described and the regulatory framework that we have for the practice of medicine and the delivery of healthcare in the United States?
So that's a really complex question, and let me share why. Right now, we are in what I would call a shared discovery process, and we need a degree of humility in terms of what we know to be, you know, true about these models and what we don't know. And that obviously has a set of profound implications on the regulators, right? So if I don't really know if my model is going to be reliable for all different kinds of people. As an example, a generative AI model that's deployed front-facing for a user to help them navigate beneficiaries, health plans, right? I can't with absolute certainty tell you that this model is going to be reliable for the individual that has a sixth grade education versus the individual that has, you know, 18 years of education, or an individual that speaks from a particular geography in the US versus a different geography. It's all based on these prompts, and these LLMs we know are not reliable and that they don't give the same answer all the time. And so if we don't know how to correct that, and we don't know how to necessarily measure that accurately, we need humility. And what that means for these labs is we're still figuring out a lot of these things. Like, we don't necessarily know how to measure bias right now. What does it mean to measure performance in these models? What does it measure? What does it mean to measure the right level of transparency and granularity in terms of data inputs and training methodology? And so we're in a shared discovery process with industry and regulators. And so I think right now, the right relationship is one that supports the kind of innovation and flexibility that we need, a la the example I gave about the HTI-1 rule, but does create some level of safeguards.
Yes.
And, you know, if you were to ask me to point to some examples, you know, let me call out, like, you know, a couple. So SB 1047 in California, right, that was, I think, just passed the assembly, has a few parts of it that are really exciting, right? It calls for a Cal compute, right? Which is, in essence, a type of quality assurance lab that tech vendors can go to, that auditors can use to create these kinds of reports. And what these reports are going to look like, we don't necessarily know exactly, but I think it's right for the legislators in California to say, we need to begin thinking about what goes into this audit report. What are the specific details? We don't necessarily have it all figured out yet. Again, we're in shared discovery, but we need to start the process and we need to do it together alongside industry and with the regulators. I think that's a great example of where setting up the process to create these kinds of impact reports and then working with the quality assurance labs over time to develop the kind of systematic, standardized ways of measuring performance, measuring bias. I think another great example is, you know, what are like the standardized testing data sets that we use? One of the things that frustrates me still to this day is we think that a holistic way of measuring the performance and the accuracy of a model, of an LLM, is, am I going to test it against the USMLE? Like, okay. As a doctor, I mean, I think, you know, you and I, we had to pass that, you know, pass our boards. But does that really capture the essence of what it means to be a good doctor? No. And so, but what are the evaluation frameworks to do that? We don't know yet. And so doing that collectively is what we urgently need to be on that mission together. Innovators and regulators working together.
Continuing that thread for just a moment, Brian, medical education is still principally a knowledge-based education. We learn a new language or multiple languages, and then we reason based upon that knowledge. And yes, we've always had access to textbooks, and over the past decade or more, we've had access to the internet, and there are curated repositories of information that are available to those of us in healthcare and to anyone. And now we have large language models. How do you think the education, both undergraduate medical education, so how we train physicians that are beginning in the practice of medicine and other healthcare professionals, how is that going to be impacted? How is our continuing medical education, knowing that when we educate physicians in medical schools and in postgraduate medical education, we're hopefully preparing them for a career that will maybe take many different avenues and areas of focus, but that will encompass 30 plus years of the rest of their lives. And yes, we have continuing medical education and continuing contact with them. But I certainly have the perception, and I bet you do too, that large language models are going to have a profound impact on the ideal way to educate physicians and also what it means to be a well-educated, highly competent physician of the future. What are your thoughts on this, at what we still said at a very early stage of the deployment of large language models in healthcare and biomedicine?
I've had the privilege and pleasure of speaking to a lot of medical students about this concept and kind of what their experience is right now. And currently, you know, many med schools, I'd say the vast majority of them, don't have the kind of robust curriculum that is preparing our clinicians for the future of, you know, using these tools. And I think one of the other important concepts is this is a tool. AI is a tool. You and I were trained how to use a stethoscope, how to use an ophthalmoscope, how to use an otoscope, how to use an echocardiogram. And we appreciated that there was a level of technical acumen that we needed to achieve in how to use this, because it's a tool. And we practiced. And we understood the quality of that tool and the appropriate use, right? You don't use an adult stethoscope on a neonate. You don't use a neonate stethoscope on an adult. And that was just something that, you know, you learn. We need to urgently begin teaching students the critical thinking skills associated with responsible AI so that they can better understand how, when an AI tool is appropriate, right? There's going to be so many different flavors of LLMs out there. Yep. We have so many different types of patients. Yep. Is the version of the LLM that I'm using in front of the patient I have now, you know, some future setting 5 years from now, is it the appropriate model for the patient I have in front of me? How do I even get to the answer to that question? Right? As a medical student, we need to teach them what are the steps, what is the critical thinking process to be able to get to that answer. And I think, you know, that's one of the more urgent things is a responsible AI curriculum that allows our students to understand how to use these tools safely and effectively. What's the pediatric stethoscope version and the adult stethoscope version based on the patients that we have in front of me? The other thing I think that's really important to realize, certainly you brought up the example of the imaging films that are now easily available at the push of a button. We need to teach students how to use these resources appropriately. I think it's an antiquated idea to teach students that we need to memorize all these different kinds of complex disease modalities. I think, and this one may, I may have a different perspective than some educators. I think teaching students how to look and where to look to find the right answer and how to integrate that into, you know, an applied, you know, specific use case or scenario with the patient is much more important than teaching patients, you know, things like the Krebs cycle or things like the different pathways of a disease evolving for COPD. It's about, I think, enabling doctors and nurses to be able to use these tools in ways that allow them to get the information that they need as quickly and as prudently as possible. But then also, once they have that, right, that tool and they're using it and they get the information, to be a critical thinker, to be a skeptic, right? This is what a scientist is. And to ask, is that right? Is that the right answer? Is that the right answer for the patient I have in front of me? Those are the kinds of things that we need to teach. And that's, I think, some of the kinds of mindset that we need to have. For continuing medical education, I think the same applies, right? Physicians that are practicing today need to urgently upskill in terms of how we use and how we think about the same principles I talked about with medical students. It's something that we're really frequently talking to a lot of medical societies, specialty societies, about is how do we partner with them to develop the kind of CME curriculum so cardiologists aren't left behind, pulmonologists, neurologists, etc. All the specialty societies can begin using these tools in ways that deliver the highest quality care.
Looking for a moment into the future, well, we've been looking into the future, but looking on a different aspect of the future, one often discussed aspect of AI is its potential to replace what humans do. In that vein, what do you see for the future of AI in healthcare? What functions currently performed by humans do you think AI will take on in the future? And how will that change how we deliver healthcare?
Such a good question. You know, it's something that, so I have the privilege and, you know, frankly, honor of working really closely with a lot of the leading developers that are members of CHAI. And one of the things that I think I've begun to think a lot of more about this concept of human flourishing as it relates to health, right? We have physical health, emotional health, spiritual health, and we each have different definitions of what flourishing means. Your definition of human flourishing might be slightly different than mine versus our listeners. And yet these AI tools, these AI models are going to be profoundly transformational, particularly if they're going to become the kinds of personal assistants that are ubiquitous across, you know, our everyday life. And we need to really ensure that these models are aligned with how we think of, how I think of human flourishing might be different than how you think of human flourishing. And is it allowing me to live my best life appropriately, safely, right? And so I'm really excited, particularly with the generative AI and a lot of the frontier models and the capabilities that they're showing, to really promote and support that kind of human flourishing. You know, for your listeners out there, they probably saw that Anthropic released some of the system prompts or root directives of one of their open source models, right? Like, what are the root principles that the model needs to adhere to above all else? This concept of what the priorities are, what the alignment of a model is to human values, to your values and my values, is, I think, going to be really critical and really important. And it really excites me. I'm optimistic that, particularly with like Anthropic leading out and saying, you know, here's our system prompts, here's our root directives, enables the kind of conversations that we need to start having around these models' alignment or misalignment to how I define human flourishing, to how you define human flourishing. and what your values and your priorities are. And I see that the closer that we can make these models that are going to be, again, every person, I think, will have the ability to have one of these kinds of tuned personal assistants. It'll be very helpful. But to ensure that those models are tuned to our values and our principles, and are respectful of others, is going to be really important and really exciting to see that conversation. And candidly, that way that we evaluate these models to assure that they are that. So we're not just taking people's word at, I promise you it's aligned, but we can actually test and validate that. Is going to be really exciting, and I think open a door for society in general to rapidly move into the kind of flourishing that we've really all hoped for a long time now.
Well, Brian, on my podcast, I always end with two questions that I like to ask all my guests. And for our conversations on AI, I'm adding a twist. First, what do you think are the most important qualities for a leader, both today and going forward, as we increasingly integrate AI into our professional and personal lives?
Certainly one of the things that I've appreciated and had to practice a lot is a sense of humility, particularly in a space like AI, where we're all learning so much. Even those of us that are spending all of our day in it, I feel like I learn something new every day. And not being confident that you know the answer and being open to being proven wrong, I think is really important, having that sense of humility that we may not have all the answers, that as an AI developer, I may not have all the answers, that I need to listen to a patient advocate from an inner city community that may not know AI, but knows what it means to have something that respects me, my values, and my principles, like what I was sharing about earlier. So I think humility is a really important skill for a leader, particularly in this AI space. I think another one is a commitment to excellence. In Chai, as I shared, we're focused very much on the technical specificity and details. And I want our team to have a level of excellence in how we define that and how we hold our quality assurance labs accountable to how they measure that, and accountability and excellence in how we transparently share that with society so that we can be trustworthy, right? Because I think with a combination of humility and commitment to excellence that we start building the kinds of trust that we need.
That's so meaningful and certainly resonates with me, and I know will with those listening to the podcast today as well. And my second and final question is, what gives you hope for the future?
It's a great question. So I am a eternal optimist when it comes certainly into the AI space. If you look at history, there really hasn't been a technology that we haven't been able to really incorporate to the benefit of society when we have really put an effort into trying our best to do that, right? Look at, through the arc of human history, when we've developed a technology and when we've adopted it and started using it in meaningful ways and incorporated it. So humans in the loop, benefit has come from that. I really believe deeply that we will find a way through that with AI. Now, there are risks, right? No doubt there are risks, but we need to be sober-minded and open-eyed about those risks. And I think that we are. The more that we include society and voices from divergent, diverse, different perspectives, the more likely it is that we're going to find the right path, right, to building AI that's going to serve all of us. It can't be built by just the tech bros in Silicon Valley or out here on the East Coast. It has to be built by all of us, or with all of us having a voice in that. And so that's what gives me optimism.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for joining me today and for that enlightening and informative conversation. And thank you for all you're doing with Chai and your many other endeavors. And thank you for listening to The Miner Consult with me, Stanford School of Medicine Dean Lloyd Miner. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion with Dr. Brian Anderson, co-founder and CEO of the Coalition for Health AI. Please send your questions by email to theminerconsult@theminerconsult.com and check out our website, theminerconsult.com, for updates, episodes, and more. To get the latest episodes of The Miner Consult, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please rate the podcast 5 stars. Your feedback helps make this podcast happen. Thank you so much for joining me today. I look forward to our next episode. Until then, stay safe, stay well, and be kind.